Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM this July 21st, 2015 edition. Episode 47 of Nature Bats Last comes live from Guy in the Mud Hut, as well as myself, Mike, from this week in Ocean Beach, California. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. In a minute, we'll speak with our guest, Mickey Z, but first, Guy has a couple tales that he would like to share.
Thanks, Mike. Welcome, everybody. I'd like to share a tale of two writers. They both interviewed me recently. John Richardson called me in early May. We talked for about an hour, and immediately before he hung up the phone, he told me he might pursue a story based on our conversation. I was a little disappointed. Spending an hour, I figured we're good to go. Then on July 6th, about 2 weeks ago, and 2 months after my conversation with Richardson, I told my wife he must have decided to ditch the story. The following day, his long, extremely interesting story was published in Esquire. In the article, he interviewed everybody I mentioned during our conversation and a couple other folks. His story was long, yet gripping. He relayed abundant information about abrupt climate change while maintaining an entertaining tone. If you haven't seen the story in Esquire by John Richardson, I strongly recommend it. About a week later, a cover story was published in the Eugene Weekly based on my presentation there on June 24th. The article was quite long and included interviews with several people. Get this, I was not one of them. That's right, the editor of this weekly newspaper attended my presentation, pulled several lines from the blog, and interviewed several people, not including me. The story was loaded with hope and marginally rooted in reality. Apparently there's a reason Esquire is, well, Esquire, and there's a reason the editor of the Eugene Weekly is writing for the local weekly rag and not writing for Esquire. That said, John Richardson, who wrote the article for Esquire, said in an interview last week that he doesn't agree with me. He says, I promote inaction, that old canard. Apparently an hour-long conversation with me saying over and over again that I promote turning off the heat engine of civilization isn't enough to convince him that I mean what I say. Apparently civilization, like hope, is unimpeachably good and thus untouchable. Back to you, Mike.
Thanks, Guy. I mean, it seems to me that Mr. Richardson maybe wanted to just keep his job. That's why I could say, you know, he doesn't agree with you.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, he's a relatively wealthy white man living in the global north. What's not to like about civilization?
True. I can relate somewhat without the wealth part. All right.
We can both relate quite well.
Today our guest is Mickey Z. Mickey, born and raised in Astoria, Queens, New York City, Mickey Z is the only person on the planet to have appeared in both a political book with Noam Chomsky and a karate flick with Billy Tybo Blanks. Armed with a high school diploma, Mickey has spoken and lectured in venues ranging from MIT to the Broadway branch of the Queens Library, from Yale University to Occupy Free University. He is the author of 13 books, most recently Occupy These Photos, to be released in September. Welcome to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network, Mickey Z.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Excellent. I followed your work for some time, and I read your blog on a regular basis. And what I love about your work is you're one of the few people that I follow that really challenges their own narrative and isn't afraid to look into the mirror, so to speak. And in one of your recent blog posts titled Activism, Balancing Distance and Presence, it delves into what you refer to as your endless evolution. And I was wondering if you could kind of expand on that and start us off, you know, right there.
Absolutely. Thank you first for being a reader of the blog. As I discussed in the article, prior to about 2011, the majority of what would be called my activism would be the talks that I gave, the books that I wrote, the articles that that appeared pretty widely on the web. For a while, I used to write for Counterpunch and ZNet until they decided they didn't want to publish me anymore. And I developed a following, and you know, it was a very gratifying way to reach people with the goal of sort of decoding propaganda. But when Occupy Wall Street started here in New York City, it kind of launched me into a situation where I got much more active in street activism, and it was also very gratifying. It was a chance to put these principles into action, so to speak. And as I mentioned in the article, what I found was that I got caught up in the excitement of being side by side with folks, and my talks and my articles shifted, because prior to that, I would write articles about ecocide and the coming collapse and be pretty much labeled gloom and doom. But then when I was on the street and people met me and saw that I didn't walk around with a gloom and doom personality, I was actually praised for being quite positive. And so I kind of fed into that until I began to realize that it was inevitably impacting my work. And so now I'm kind of in a place where I'm challenging myself to make sure that I'm being true to my vision as a writer and a public speaker and so on, yet maintaining the ability to be a compassionate comrade when I do engage in street activism. And it's a challenging situation, because you could be writing an article about, for example, right now everybody's already talking about the elections, and I could, you know, my take on the elections is unconventional compared to the average street activist. And so I'll write something, it'll make the rounds on the web, and then I could be standing side by side with someone on the street that I offended deeply with this article, and I have to be okay with that. And it's part of this endless evolution where I just decide I have to keep challenging myself to evolve and learn as much as possible and surrender as much as possible of this privilege that's been bestowed upon me.
Yeah, and that's what I find fascinating. You know, I can read things from you 2-3 years later, and you'll kind of go back and challenge what you wrote back then. That's another thing I actually appreciate about Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen seems to actually do it in the same book he's writing. He'll be like, I'll be reading in the beginning of the book, and by the end of the book, he's changed his mind about something he wrote earlier in the book, which is fascinating to me.
That's why my books are short, by the way. That's why I keep my books real short.
I can remember one time having a situation on Facebook with Mike where we had a little bit of a disagreement, and I was contemplating that before this phone call, and I wish I could recall the exact specifics of the disagreement, but one thing I know for certain is that because we're the type of people that keep evolving, I'm absolutely certain that if the same situation were to arise today, that the outcome would be completely different, because to me, that's the way to go, is just keep challenging yourself to not be afraid, you know, that if you get called out, don't respond with ego, respond with excitement that this is a learning moment. This is a chance to learn from someone else's experience. And I know I'm preaching to the converted here, but as a middle-aged white man, there's a lot of experiences I don't understand. So I try and keep my eyes and ears and mind wide open so I can be as compassionate an accomplice and ally as I can be.
Yeah, and you mentioned ego, and that's really what started the conversation or the conflict between you and I. I made some off-the-cuff remark about something, I'm sure. And by the end of the conversation, it started with a bunch of ego between us, but it ended ended in a place where we kind of stepped back and observed what we were actually doing in the conversation, which wasn't anything constructive, as far as I can recall, which I was happy with. Sometimes they don't end well, but this one seemed to end pretty well, so.
Yeah, and I'm really happy that was the case. And the reason I brought it up was just to point out that it was something that I learned from. And I appreciate that. Yeah, I appreciate that because that's the only option in interactions like that is what's the takeaway message? What can I learn from this and be better next time?
Absolutely. And I think a good way that I've learned from you that you do this is you actually list your goals as an activist. And you wrote in Veganism, Harm Reduction, and Moral Baselines, and et cetera, you listed your goals and you state your basic goal is harm reduction. And then you started by listing your goals of checking your privilege and becoming a better ally and keeping and learning to keep an open mind, which we just talked about, and finding out, you know, that you enjoy finding out that you are wrong about things from time to time. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about your goals and why you put them down.
That particular article has grown out of a situation where because I got involved very, very intensely with the street activism, one aspect of that was that in New York City there's a fair amount of street activism connected to animal rights issues and tangentially veganism. And I've been a vegan for 20 years. For the first part of that 20 years, it was something about me that I was a vegan, but the primary aspects of my writing and public speaking didn't connect to that in any way. As I got more and more involved in street activism, I became known as that. And I made a decision when I started on Facebook. They wouldn't let me use Mickey Z, just Z as a name. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, maybe I can meet fellow vegans on here. And I kind of flippantly made it Mickey Z-Vegan. And the more I got to know people on the street and via Occupy and so on, they knew me as Mickey Z-Vegan. It was like one word, practically. They'd say it so quickly. And over time, I became quite disillusioned. The more time I spent around my fellow vegans, the more disillusioned I became because it's a very privileged movement. It's a very myopic movement. And I didn't really want to be associated with those aspects, so I tried as a welcome member of that so-called community to talk to them about such issues, and I wasn't the only one. There were other people doing this, and the result was I became ostracized from this group, and it began to really, really cause me to question some of the dogma that I had been constantly repeating as a vegan. And a big part of that was this whole concept of harm reduction, where vegans will tell you, they'll say that veganism should be the moral baseline. That's a very well-known line from one of their gurus. And it's pretty arbitrary in the grand continuum of harm reduction to pick this, you know, consumer veganism as the moral baseline of harm reduction, because there, again, you guys know better than anyone that there's so many other steps you can take on that continuum. And so I thought it was time for me to write an article in which I owned up to at times being proud to be a vegan in a very superior, morally righteous way, and not something I'm proud of when I look back at it now, and try to re-establish and reinvent my perception as what I can do as a middle-class man in this industrial civilization, that my personal choices aren't that huge, but can I participate less in exploitation? How can I reduce the harm that I'm directly causing, and in some cases indirectly causing, as opposed to deluding myself that I can end suffering in any way, shape, or form? And that article was very, very cathartic for me in the sense that it was really shedding this identity that had been imposed upon me, but then I embraced it. And now I say, no, it's time to sort of destroy that platform and unlearn some of the stuff that I learned and come back, reinvent myself in a far more holistic way, and in some cases go back to what I used to be before, prior to getting involved in very specific causes, in seeing a bigger picture and promoting a bigger picture.
Have you, with the article, I'm certain you talked about it a little bit, that there was some probably serious blowback from the vegan community, but have you found some support within the community as well?
Well, what's fascinating is that I've been able to connect with people within the vegan and animal rights scene that are facing the same issues, and not surprisingly, the people facing these issues and recognizing how white supremacists the vegan movement is. These are vegans of color. These are women. These are coming from groups that are traditionally oppressed. And so when they just make a personal choice to become a vegan and then say, hey, I want to show up at one of these demos and I don't agree with the fur industry, or I want to end the carriage horse industry in New York City, and then they get out there and just see that the same hierarchies from the mainstream culture are just being replicated within the vegan and animal rights movement, they're immediately hip to it. It took me a long time to see it because I'm so privileged, it's harder for me to recognize that I've walked into this movement in a different position than them. So I am blessed in the sense that I was able to meet people who identify as vegans or animal rights activists, but come at it from a very intersectional perspective. And that's ultimately where I want to be. I really want to keep focusing on intersectionality and recognizing where all these forms of oppression and all these struggles against oppression can work together.
Absolutely. And speaking of movements, you were involved, as you mentioned earlier, in Occupy. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what impact you think it had on maybe the dominant culture, and what do you think it's the beginning of something on the horizon to come? Or is Occupy just kind of still under the surface? And, you know, kind of take us where you think it's gone and where it's going.
Well, that's a difficult question that I am not going to pretend I'm fully qualified to answer, but I can give you my perspective and my opinion on it. Occupy itself, in particular Occupy Wall Street based here in New York City, did something that attracted me instantly as opposed to other movements, where it set up this recognition of the 99%, where it connected issues that there is this top 1% that is benefiting far more from industrial civilization and is far more responsible for the destruction of the ecosystem. You know, we all play a role, but then there are these global criminals. And I love that. And when I first walked into Zuccotti Park back in September 2011, there used to be signs on the floor before the tents went up. People put down these cardboard signs. The first sign I saw when I walked in was industrial civilization is murdering the earth. And right there, I started weeping. I was like, oh my God, like this is like a street protest that's not going away. They're sleeping in the park and they're putting these big pieces together. So for all those reasons, I was grateful for it. And I think that the connected activists that previously had dwelled very much in single issue realms, unfortunately Occupy was also had a tendency to replicate some of the hierarchies from mainstream, and it was primarily white middle class. Mm-hmm. And so needless to say, that was and male oriented, and needless to say, those issues were part of it not being able to fully sustain itself. Of course, a big part was nonstop state repression and corporate propaganda. But what I do see now is that many of the aspects and the connections made during Occupy and during the time period after Hurricane Sandy here, where it was Occupy Wall Street that stepped up, renamed themselves Occupy Sandy, and were the most important people on the ground where people's lives were in danger. And, you know, I was out at Rockaway Beach and I saw it firsthand. These connections have manifested in ways that have helped bolster newer movements and far more intersectional movements like Black Lives Matter. And so I think that Occupy has an enduring legacy, and it may even lose its sense of being Occupy. But when I was just at a protest the other night, a rally, it was 1 year since Eric Garner, a black man who was murdered on videotape by NYPD, and the cop was let off without an indictment. It was 1 year since his murder, and there was a giant protest in March here in New York City, and I watched the tactics that the Black Lives Matter organizers use, and the organizing tactics and so on, and many of them come right out of Zuccotti Park. And so I know that the connections are there and that there is going to be a legacy, but what I'd like to believe that is the seeds that Occupy may have planted will grow in a far more holistic and intersectional way, because Occupy as it stood wasn't going to change the world. It was too white, it was too male, it was too middle class, but it made connections and created coalitions that I think stand a chance to make bigger changes elsewhere.
Well, you just opened a 55-gallon drum of worms for me with your connections between privilege and industrial civilization, how we live. Clearly, you get it. You're able to make those conclusions based on your analysis of these intersecting factors, but a whole bunch of people still don't. And here I'm thinking about people that look a lot like us, you and me and Mike. You know, people who are mostly white, mostly male, and mostly living in the global north. So a couple of questions. What allowed you to get it that these myriad predicaments have this root in industrial civilization? And what other people and organizations, from your perspective, get that as well?
To go to the first question first, I would like to think that I'm a work in progress. I continue to get things that just a couple of weeks ago were absolutely invisible to me. So I don't want to phrase that I got it, because that assumes some sense of being a finished product, and it's not even close. I'm always open to learning more, and I recognize how much I need to learn. I think what worked in my favor is that although I did really well in school, I didn't like it, and I didn't go to college, and I didn't follow a traditional academic paradigm, and really set off on a sense of self-education, where when I would meet people here in New York City, sort of fringe characters, not necessarily politically fringe characters, but culturally fringe characters, they would turn me on to people. I remember being turned on years and years ago to Guy Debord and a Situationist, and I was constantly challenged and invigorated by the stories of people that broke the mold and didn't believe what they were being sold, essentially. And eventually I came around to reading Chomsky's work, Manufacturing Consent, and that really inspired me, because a common theme in much of my writing has been some sense of decoding propaganda. I felt like the work that he did and people like him were like a Rosetta Stone, in the sense that it guided me into really, really, carefully guarding my own ability to think and recognize and be a critical thinker, as opposed to accepting what I was being told. So that groundwork that was laid relatively young in life enabled me to move through these different circles and learn from people. And I am not exaggerating when I say that when I do encounter people and they just blow my mind and tell me, blah, blah, do you think this is true? But let me show you a different bit of evidence. I love it. Then I'll go off on my own researching and finding more information, writing about it. So I love that process there. As for how other people are getting it, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, we grew up without the internet as our primary source of information, so we had to seek out stuff. Now people are bombarded with information, and it's very easy to not get it if you come from a certain demographic. But it's also equally as easy to just push a few buttons and find some new information. And so I think the explosion of technology can go both ways, in the sense that it can keep particularly white men in their little bubble, because they don't want to surrender what they have or they think they have. But it also introduces us and has us interact with people that we never could have met in any other circumstance. And I like to believe that that's happening in that sense. But this is where I do feel good about street activism, meetings, face-to-face type of stuff, because none of this is, true solidarity usually is created face-to-face, where you could see, where you could hear the inflection in someone's voice, you could see the facial expressions, and you could pick up the nuances of who they are. And people do, when I give talks and stuff, people ask me questions about Twitter this or this social media, that social media. And I will point out, that the anti-slavery movement in the 1800s managed to do what they did without a Twitter account. And these people, the labor movement and the Emma Goldmans of the world, these people met face-to-face under often incredible threats. And they met face-to-face and created these coalitions in solidarity. And I hope that we don't continue to move too far away from that, because I think that's where the true connections and learning occurs, enabling people like us to get it more, because that's where we're exposed to ideas that we aren't normally, and we get called out when we, even if it's inadvertently, express our privilege in a certain way. And that's been the best cases for me, where I'm out in public I'm beginning to talk, and afterwards someone comes up to me and just basically calls me out on something that I said, and I can't replace that with any other way except that face-to-face connection.
That's right. Face-to-face, there's just absolutely no substitute. And you look at the kind of discourse that passes for civil discourse online, and it's no small wonder to me that we're in the dire straits we're in. But face-to-face, with the ability to read body language and to follow up and to add nuance, it's a completely different environment than the way we spend most of our lives, it seems to me. So can you follow up more about that? We don't learn anything with our mouth open, obviously. If I'm talking, it's hard for me to take anything in. What kind of significant encounters have you had and do you continue to have that influence your worldview based on sitting across the table from somebody?
I'll give you one example because I mentioned the whole break that I had from the animal rights community. And I was doing a talk at a radical bookstore here in New York City last year, early last year. And it was a talk that took place after a screening of the movie Blackfish. People probably know what that is, but just really quickly, it's an expose of the treatment of orcas at SeaWorld. So after the movie, I stood up and I gave a talk about captivity and so on. And in the talk, I flippantly referred to orcas in that situation as slaves, in the sense that they're owned by other beings, work for those beings, and the beings make money off of them. And I made a little bit, I went too far into that comparison. I started with it, and I stayed with it for too long. I went back, and a woman that works there, African-American woman, came up to me afterwards because she knew me, and I thank her for this because she chose to talk to me privately. And she came up to me afterwards and just said, you know that apples-to-apples comparison you made of orcas and the transatlantic slave trade? And before I could answer, she said, you probably shouldn't do that. She said, don't do that. And my immediate reaction was, no, that's not what I did. I didn't make apples. You know, I tried to, and then she basically explained to me a little bit more. And then we spoke more after that. And then I pondered that on the subway on the way home, and I pondered, people that know me can tell you, I really thought about this, and the reality hit me that this, in the animal rights movement, when the words like slavery and Holocaust and rape are so casually used, how insensitive and also completely ineffective this language is. And it's completely changed my perspective into how I would discuss cruelty against animals and how I would be far more sensitive to the struggle of people who struggles I don't understand. And I, to this day, I'm still in touch with that woman, and I can't even emphasize how much she, the journey that she set me off on. She corrected me on one aspect, but then the connections made from there continue to this day, right up to that article that Mike mentioned about the harm reduction and veganism, where I'm still deconstructing parts of where my mindset was as sort of a major. That's one example. But this type of stuff, thankfully, happens on a regular basis, and I like to think it's built up a fair amount of credibility, that people understand that if I do say something that I deserve to be called out on, that... Hello?
Hello?
Oh, sorry. This phone's making some strange noise. I'm sorry. Even if I do something that I deserve to be called out on, over the years of doing what I do, I'm grateful that I built up enough credibility that people are willing to take a chance on me and say, hey, can I explain to you what I think you just did or what I definitely know you just did? And I take that as quite a compliment that I'm not immediately dismissed, and I'm given a chance to hear them out and make some changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that comes from just like doing the work year after year after year after year. And like you said, having the ability and lack of ego to reflect on it. And that, for me, those are the moments that, like you said, they shift your life. And I'm grateful that people actually take the time and feel it's worthwhile to actually call me out when I get called out. And so I'm thankful for those, even though in those moments they can be incredibly difficult. But I look at the growth that I make from them, and like you mentioned, I'm just thankful that they happen.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you basically articulated how I feel, because it would be understandable if people if we said something as insensitive, in my case, as comparing the whales with slaves and so on, it would be understandable if somebody just basically wrote me off right there. And the fact that they still were willing to take their time and compassionately explain stuff to me is such a huge compliment, A, and what an opportunity. I mean, how could I pass up that opportunity to contemplate what this person wants to share with me? And I'd like to believe in that specific case that I kind of took it and ran. It really was a turning point in terms of how I perceive intersectionality in terms of where animal rights fits in.
Right on.
Yeah, I would go a step further and say, at least in my case, that no significant learning occurs without discomfort. That if we aren't uncomfortable, then we aren't really learning anything of any significance. But maybe that's just me.
No, I agree. That discomfort, it's a familiar feeling, because if you do this long enough, you're gonna feel it. But you start to recognize it as like, okay, I'm about to go through one of these time periods where 2 months from now, people are going to be reading what I write and be like, whoa, that's different. And I'll be like, yeah, it's definitely different. And watch what's coming next, because I'm just, this is a process. This is, as I said before, I'm a work in progress and proud of it. And I'm honored to have any platform that people do care what I write or what I say in public talks. So I take that quite seriously, that it's my responsibility to continue challenging myself. If I have an audience of any type, I want to honor and respect that audience as much as I can.
Sure, and I very much appreciate your humility in saying that you're a work in progress. All of us are, obviously, but it seems that relatively few people are willing to admit it. You're listening to Nature Bat Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. We're discussing today with Mickey Z a wide variety of what's going on in the world and our take on it.
Speaking of discomfort, when we talk about the United States and the decline of American empire, It's something that brings a lot of discomfort to people, and a lot of people deny that it's actually happening at all, and most of those people seem to be in power. I was wondering what you foresee. I'm asking you to kind of look in your crystal ball. I know, people don't generally like to make predictions, but do you see, have you seen a slow decline? Do you see something rapid happening to American empire?
All I can do is guess, and you guys certainly are know more about this than I do, but it seems to me, based on what I'm watching, is that there is a rapid decline already in place. It's just that it's pretty well hidden and kind of caught up in the spectacle of American life. So the question to me would be, when is that decline going to be recognizable, or when are they going to be unable to fully obscure and hide that decline? Because it's happening, and how many more Bernie Sanders can they pull out of their hat to distract the pseudo-liberal crowd to think like, see, look how fair this system is. You have Trump on one end and Sanders on the other. How many times can that trick still work? When there's no trees left, when there's no large fish in the ocean, so I don't know what the answer would be in that sense, but it's probably going to be, when I look at movements like Black Lives Matter organically growing out of Ferguson, but based on centuries of white supremacy and oppression, I would like to think that it's going to be groups like that are going to be the primary movers in terms of waking up people, letting us realize how bad things are, and perhaps having some sense of an infrastructure that people can plug in and get involved, or at the very least create a softer place to land. But it's hard to say. I remember about 4 years ago, I was interviewing Derek Jensen, because we've known each other for years, and one of the questions I asked him was, you've said so much in your life about this collapse and the end game and so on. But as you look over just the past couple of years of what's happening, did you ever imagine that you'd be alive when things were accelerating at this pace? And I think he answered something along the lines like, no, it's almost surreal to theoretically talk about this could happen, and then it is happening. So to me, the question is, how much longer can they effectively hide it? And I will be as interested a witness to this as anyone else, but I don't have any specific, or any logical guesses on when that will happen. But it seems at some point that there's going to be too much happening that it can be hidden by the usual spectacle.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And it is a spectacle or a series of spectacles, and it's being stunningly well hidden. I was at coffee this morning. I go to coffee every Tuesday morning with several of my neighbors. And typically, there's about a dozen people there, and these are pretty radical folks. You know, they live in the rural countryside, and they don't follow the mainstream media, and what little they do follow, they don't really believe what comes out of the mainstream media. So I was stunned today when somebody shows up and starts talking about how big the crowds were for Bernie Sanders in Phoenix, and oh my, isn't this going to be great? This is going to change everything. And I thought, you know, I heard this once before. It was 6 or 8 years ago when the Great Hope was running at that time. And I'm just astonished by the ability of the American populace to carry on and to always find that unimpeachably good emotion, hope.
Yes. This has been an interesting topic because I actually was talking about it on social media today, where I promised myself this election cycle that I wasn't going to get caught up in the minutiae of all these debates, and you get dragged into it because, as you mentioned, someone comes up to you and says, "Can you believe what's happening with Sanders?" And you can't remain silent at that point. You have to wade into it. But one of the things that appears to be the case from my interactions with people is that it's really challenging to get people to surrender their long dedicated belief to the two-party system. It's something that Americans cling to as superior and as proof of democracy. And if you tell them the only difference between the two parties is they tell different lies to get elected, they look at you, as a conspiracy theorist or whatever so-called pejorative they want to use. But they don't want to surrender that myth. And it's so easy then to prey on them every 4 years. And Sanders is the latest, messiah, if you will, in this game, although he tells you straight out, if he doesn't win, he'll endorse whoever gets the candidacy. We've seen this rerun 1,000 times, and yet it just keeps happening, and people are passionate about it. Like, they're more passionate about that system than their own health, for example. They'll want to argue and debate and talk about the elections from now till next November nonstop. And so it's a victory of corporate propaganda. And I come back to that a lot. I just think that the greatest thing, like what you guys do with this show, is we just have to keep challenging the dominant narrative, because that is what makes it possible for people to believe that this time around it's different. Sanders is the real deal, and it'll be someone else in 4 to 8 years. And what can we do to challenge that narrative, and how can we buck against this giant system of corporate propaganda? That's been sort of the underlying unifying thread of my work from the time I first ever started writing. And it's exciting at times because of social media, because people are able to connect in a way that they couldn't in the past, where they can hear opinions that they couldn't have gotten in the past. But then just as easily, things go viral so quickly, like Sanders, that it almost becomes like all you need is a meme of a quote of his, whether he actually said the quote or not, and then that's the truth, and everybody lines up behind it, and it's just exasperating. So I don't know. What do you guys think in terms of, like, when you're talking to people in your life that say, how about that Sanders, how do you respond?
I go through. It's like the mafia. You think you're out of it, and then it just keeps pulling you back in. Like you said, you cannot escape it. And when people bring it up to you in person, yeah, you have to respond. I've just gotten to the point where sometimes it depends on the day if I want to fight that battle and if I want to go there. Really, I don't know about Guy, but
well, yeah, me too. I mean, so today at coffee, I was pretty quiet. There were only about 8 people there, and they're my friends, and I don't want to point out the idiocy of even arguing. You know, the system is the problem, and it doesn't really matter which of the two sides of the corporate ass gets put into the Oval Office at this point. I can promise you only one thing, that the next president will be the worst president of my life, and that pattern has held up through my entire life so far. I just can't see breaking that pattern suddenly.
Yeah, I mean, the system is such that it wouldn't allow anyone to break that pattern. I mean, these individuals that get to the point where they're in position to raise that kind of money and be invited to participate in the debates, how many decades have they been internalizing these values? I mean, they're not, you know, and people still walk around saying, well, Obama wanted to make change over the past 7 years, but the Republicans wouldn't let him. And like you said, you at that moment you have to decide: do I really want to have an argument or possibly lose a friend right here? Because how do you process that? And I know that I hope that doesn't sound like some sense of superiority. It's to me it's just straight up frustration. I don't dislike a person who says that or think I'm better. I've done a lot of work in trying to break away from the lies of the American system, and I desperately want to share what I've learned. And then when someone can say that, it's just so damn frustrating, because you think if we could break this stranglehold that corporate America has on our collective mindset, then really anything is possible. But I have yet to figure out a definitive way to make any progress in breaking that stranglehold.
So do you think, based on what we've talked about here with, you know, the dominant narrative, do you think Occupy, in a sense, is really white America, some aspect of it, realizing that there is a crack in the dominant narrative, and that's and they finally kind of had a come-to-Jesus moment, so to speak, and that was the reaction, was Occupy?
I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. The people that I've gotten to know and still know came from a very broad spectrum within a narrow spectrum. Like, there still were many, many groups of people that weren't effectively involved or represented or active in Occupy. But as I said, it's carried over to Black Lives Matter. And I do see these moments of revelation where I could think of one individual in particular who, she lived on Staten Island, and Hurricane Sandy hit, and the damage on Staten Island was intensive. So Occupy Sandy went there, set up tents, and stayed for many months. And this particular woman would come down to the staging area to volunteer and got to know people, and in that process talk politics and talk about what you guys did and what was really going on in Zuccotti, and, you know, did you guys have any demands, and, you know, all the stuff that people heard of. Long story short, I still see her at all the actions now. And just as a reminder, that was late 2012 when Sandy hit here. So these moments occur, and I've witnessed some of them myself. And even as someone who came to Occupy with decades of radical experience, I still learned by being around people that were different from me and had different experiences. So, yeah, I don't want to downplay Occupy as exposing those cracks, but I don't think it was going to be the conduit that perhaps Black Lives Matter can be. I think that conduit is far more intersectional, and I think that's the only avenue that we can take it. If we aren't connecting these struggles against all forms of oppression, we're doomed to failure. And so Black Lives Matter is closer to that, but Occupy definitely laid a foundation and exposed some of the cracks and lured in people that previously would never have set foot near a protest.
Right on.
You know, at the peak of the Occupy movement, there was a kerfuffle created around Black Bloc. Is it a group? Is it a strategy? Chris Hedges and Derek Jensen create a lot of heat around the Black Bloc issue, and I still don't understand what happened there. Can you bring some light to the conversation?
it's an interesting paradigm. In my experience with activism, one of the and I don't really understand Derek's problem with it, so I don't want to. So this isn't a challenge to him because I didn't understand what his critique of it was. And Chris Hedges to me was a newcomer to it, and he kind of was talking. He didn't have enough information. Like he showed up at Zuccotti, and he wasn't really involved prior to that. But in New York City activism, one of the traditional conflicts is people want to make change within the system, and then there's the anarchists. And so the belief is that the people who want to make change will petition the city for a permit, and they'll follow a parade route, and they'll try. And if there are going to be arrests, they'll agree with the NYPD in advance of how many it's going to be. The anarchists, on the hand, will throw a bottle through Starbucks window. That's sort of the general belief of it. And I just think that got exaggerated to the point where it was convenient for the more liberal part of Occupy to blame this anarchist group for anything that went wrong within Occupy. Ultimately, everybody played a role. A lot of anarchist principles, horizontalism and so on, were huge within Occupy. And one of the things that I started writing about when I saw the Hedges thing about the Black Bloc was I just kind of renamed the NYPD the Blue Bloc, and I just kept pointing out that the real danger on the street was the gang in blue. They're the ones that have the license to kill, and they're the ones that we really should be fearing and focusing on. If you want to talk about a violent group of people that all dress alike, hide their faces, I mean, it sounded like a far more dangerous group than the Black Bloc. So I think it was sort of a... It might even have been a provocateur type of thing to deflect people and cause tension within the groups, but I didn't see any reason why these groups couldn't coexist. Everybody played a role. Everybody can play a role, and I think it's really, really important to keep the eyes on who the enemy could be. Not that the police necessarily are the enemy. They're just the protectors of the 1%, but in terms of, like, who's going to be on that march with you that is most likely to wreak havoc and cause violence and maybe kill someone, it's the cops, not a group of anarchists with a bandana around their head. So I think we kind of lost perspective in that debate right there.
Well, right. It's so easy. We're human beings, and we have this profound sense of community, and yet at the same time this profound sense of otherness. We can find the other in any individual or small group of people. So it's pretty easy for us to get splintered, and it seems like that's one of the things that happened to Occupy. So I know surrender is not an option, but what are the odds Black Lives Matter meets the same fate as Occupy does and just becomes splintered and sort of fritters away?
Well, I mean, the state is working hard on making that happen. I mean, these groups are openly infiltrated, and a couple of years after Occupy, the story started to come out more often that people that we would see standing right, I can remember marching with Occupy and having somebody marching right next to me who a year later I saw his picture in the paper, he was a cop. So these splinterings often, they can happen on their own because there's a lot of ego in activism, as there is everywhere in human interactions, but it could be provoked through provocateurs and police actions and state repression. The cracking down on Black Lives Matter, just the other day when this action happened at Columbus Circle here, within 2 minutes of the first speaker talking, a bunch of cops waded into the crowd and just arrested a black man. Like it's like they singled out a guy and took him away and never really explained why they were taking him away. And it has a very chilling effect where people might be like, you know, I really want to support the cause, but, you know, I got to go to work tomorrow. I can't spend 30 hours in prison in jail for processing.
Right.
I'll lose my job. I can't pay my bills. These are very effective tactics by the state. So I know the state is hard at work to do whatever they can to splinter Black Lives Matter. I just wonder, to go back to the question earlier, as things continue to progressively get worse in sense of social, economic, and environmental collapse, how much longer can they continue to splinter the groups that the few groups that offer any sense of another direction or any sense of solidarity or as I said, trying to create even just a slightly softer place to land. So I support these groups wholeheartedly. I go to the events. I take photos. In particular, Black Lives Matter, I don't want to be front and center anywhere. You know, I want to be a silent ally. And one of the things I do at at their actions is I take photos and then I share those photos as widely as possible with as much information in the captions as I can, and I do that little part to play a role in it, and I encourage others to do the same. And I hope that, you know, that the seeds of Occupy can spring up in other types of movements like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's what's interesting about, or what's, it's not interesting, it just is, about Black Lives Matter is the people that started that movement have been in collapse their entire lives. And whereas I, myself, I have not really experienced any collapse. And so to learn and listen and support a movement where people their entire lives have been in collapse, I think is an important distinction from any movement that I've, you know, have followed or tried to be an ally to.
I'd like to point out that you live in a tent.
Right, I live in a tent, but
I'm going to make a quick anecdote here where what, unfortunately, as you know, every now and then, like almost on a cyclical basis, there is a police murder of a black person in New York City. And so actions then spring up in those exact communities of where it happened. And it's very enlightening to go to these communities in solidarity and support and to recognize that those folks who live there, how they process this, because, as you said, this is daily life. You know, I go there and I witness what's happening and taken away with this profound sense of grief and loss and trying to figure things out. And they've already created all these survival mechanisms to deal with living a life of perpetual oppression and having the state on their back 24 hours a day. And so how can we not learn an absolute ton from people like that? So it's just so crucial that we're in those situations to, as you said before, you close your mouth and keep your ears open and learn. And just learn and see what we can learn from that struggle and how we can be a better accomplice and ally in future struggles.
Absolutely. So let's talk about, you know, because you mentioned your pictures and what you're doing, and speaking of which, you have a book coming out. So let's talk a little bit about the book coming out and its purpose.
Oh, thank you. It's called Occupy These Photos. I had a book come out last year from Sullivan Street Press called Occupy This Book, a little play on the Abby Hoffman book, and that was about activism, some personal anecdotes and so on. And Sullivan Street Press approached me and said, well, you've been taking photos right from the beginning of Occupy, right now straight through to Black Lives Matter. Maybe we could put together a book. And we did. We did, and it's coming out in September. If people find me on social media, which is really easy if you just look up Mickey Z, it's already available for pre-order. But if you don't get it yet, there'll be a lot written, you know, in reviews and interviews after September. But it's called Occupy These Photos. The publisher is Sullivan Street Press, and it's a collection of images that go back to the early days of Zuccotti, right up to earlier this year, in some of the more intense, what we used to have die-ins related to Black Lives Matter in around Christmas season, late 2014, disrupting the shopping season and so on. There were some amazing actions put together by Black Lives Matter in these major rich department stores in New York City, where suddenly everybody would just drop to the floor in a die-in, and they used the mic checks, the human mic stuff that came out of Zuccotti. And so I was happy to be there and document it with photos. And so the book itself sort of follows me from Zuccotti Park right up to Black Lives Matter today, and just encourages people to get involved in these issues and see that they're not only needed, but these struggles also involve them. And we're in this together. And the more we recognize, like we could celebrate our differences without assigning privilege to them. And if we work together, then we have a chance. We have a chance of creating that crack. Of letting people understand that the two-party system is a lie and that you're being lied to by the media and so on and so forth, and give people a chance to trust them that once they have more information, they're going to make better decisions.
Well, well said. Thank you very much for your time, Mickey, and hopefully we can talk to you down the road. It's been very enlightening, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to speak to you guys, and I really appreciate you giving me this much time to talk.
Absolutely. Anytime. That was Mickey Z, blogger, author, and activist. Guy, what do you have for us?
Thanks again to Mickey Z. That was a great interview. I really appreciate you taking the time. On the climate change front, I have a few updates. First, climate engineering not an option for near-term climate policy, according to the headline of an article about the European Transdisciplinary Assessment of Climate Engineering. That's U-TRACE is the name of the group. The Europe-wide group of scientists finally caught up with reality and the United States National Academy of Sciences on July 15, 2015, in concluding that we can't engineer our way out of this mess with respect to abrupt climate change. Second, feedback number 17 gains traction with a paper by Jason Box and colleagues out of Greenland based on data now 4 years old. Data were collected in 2011, a paper published online in the July 13, 2015 issue of Nature Geoscience finds, quote, given that the advection of warm, moist air masses and rainfall over Greenland is expected to become more frequent in the coming decades, our findings portend a previously unforeseen vulnerability of the Greenland ice sheet to climate change. Briefly, in other words, melting of the Greenland ice sheet has been shown to accelerate in response to surface rainfall and melt associated with these weather events. So a warmer atmosphere leads to more rainfall because a warmer atmosphere is able to hold more moisture than a cooler atmosphere, and that leads to melting of the ice sheet, hence increasing the warming of the atmosphere. Classic self-reinforcing feedback loop. Third item, as we've known since early 2009, Earth's atmosphere will harbor, at a minimum, the current warming potential of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration for at least the next 1,000 years. That, according to a paper in the January 28, 2009 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States. It turns out the marine situation is similarly catastrophic. The Guardian's headline from July 16, 2015 screams, quote, warming of oceans due to climate change is unstoppable, say U.S. scientists, end quote. The headlines are describing the annual state of the climate in 2014 report from the United States. Greg Johnson, an oceanographer at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, compared the ocean to a freight train, quote, it takes a big push to get it going, but it is moving now and will continue to move along after we continue to push it. So the freight train has been pushed. It's going ever faster down the track. The ocean will not stop warming for several thousand years. And I've added three, count them, three new self-reinforcing feedback loops. It's been a busy week. Their numbers 53, 54, and 55 for those of you keeping score at home. According to the July 13, 2015 online edition of Nature Climate Change, as jet planes burn fuel and release carbon dioxide, the atmosphere warms and causes headwinds to build up. The added drag on air travel means more fuel is burned to travel the same distance, thus adding greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. This is a loop we could stop if we wanted, merely by stopping all air travel. I'll be holding my breath on that one. The other two self-reinforcing feedback loops, in contrast, are irreversible. Cryptogamic covers, which were called cryptogamic crusts when I was studying them in graduate school about 1,000 years ago, comprise some of the oldest forms of terrestrial life. In 2012, it was discovered they fixed large amounts of nitrogen and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. They are sources of greenhouse gases, notably including nitrous oxide and methane, with higher temperatures and enhanced nitrogen deposition contributing to amplification or increasingly rapid release of greenhouse gases. This information comes from the July 7th, 2015 issue of Global Change Biology. And finally, according to a paper in the July 17th, 2015 issue of Science Advances, plankton in the Southern Ocean are responsible for creating nearly half of the water droplets in the clouds during the summer, thus serving as a cooling agent. And plankton are seriously declining due to warming and acidification of the ocean. The more it warms, the less plankton are able to create droplets and therefore cool the planet. So not only are we talking about the base of the marine food web and roughly half the food humans eat, we're talking about the ability to cool the planet, which is rapidly, very rapidly going away. So that's enough bad news for one day, I should think, or maybe even 1 week.
All right, Guy, well, that's about it. We have a survey where you can fill out at GuyMcPherson.com about the show. You can like us on Facebook page, Progressive Radio Network, or join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Best Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions and go to Guy's blog for further updates, GuyMcPherson.com. We'll see you next Tuesday on the radio at 3 p.m. Eastern. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our guest, Mickey Z. for his time and work, and thanks to Amazon for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Bam.